The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute. If you're looking for a place where the classroom work is carried out in a similar spirit to what we do here at PEL, you might want to consider St. John's College. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 151 is something like, what role should tradition have in politics? And we'll be discussing Edmund Burke's pamphlet, Reflections on the Revolution in France from 1790. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, in need of reformation but not revolution, in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, antiently in Middleton, Wisconsin.
So Burke, we covered Burke a few years ago, his aesthetics, one of his early things. This is one of his later things. And it was, Wikipedia did say it's a pamphlet, but it's 200 pages or 300 pages, depending on what version you have.
It's 300 pages in a Penguin paperback.
And originally was written as a letter, in a letter intended to have been sent to a gentleman in Paris, is the subtitle, one of the subtitles.
Yeah, that's not to be believed by me.
Well, apparently he really corresponded with this guy.
And he corresponded with lots of people.
So this was written before the terror, but it was after the French Revolution. He talks about October 6th, 1789, and this came out about a year later. He actually finished it, I think, but it was supposed to be a young person there asked him, sort of expecting him to be in favor of it because he had, well, he wasn't in favor of the American Revolution, but he had said things that were supportive of the rebels' position before they actually rebelled, of giving them more freedom and being more responsible empire.
And then also there, not just the American Revolution, but he's a Whig, the party traditionally that grew out of support for what they call the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which was a revolution that, aside from kind of bringing back anti-Catholic persecution and sort of an ongoing battle between the power of the parliament and the power of the monarch in England, sort of established the power of the parliament once and for all and established a Bill of Rights and things, which looks very similar to the American Bill of Rights. So in a way, as a kind of pro-parliament Whig who's sort of pro-Glorious Revolution, you would think that he might be pro-French Revolution. And in fact, the kind of people he's going to be responding to associate the French Revolution with the Glorious Revolution and see it as the same sort of thing. And he's going to try and debunk that idea in this pamphlet.
Especially the beginning of the book is an explicit reaction against it, particularly the idea that you can have a rational monarchy. You don't have to take it as divinely mandated and the powers of the king in that way. You can have a principle of monarchy, including inherited monarchy, as being perfectly rational and part of the constitution of Britain in a perfectly acceptable way.
Let me just add more to what the Glorious Revolution. King James II of England was a Catholic, and that was okay as long as he wasn't going to start a Catholic dynasty. But when he had a son as an heir, it seemed like that might happen. And so basically, the parliamentarians kind of invited William III, William of Orange, a Dutch guy, to come invade England and become king. And that's partly because he was married to James's daughter, so that there's some rationale for having him do that. That'll be relevant later on when we discuss Burke's defense of hereditary monarchs and the sense in which the Glorious Revolution isn't like the French Revolution and so on.
All right, so why are we reading this as a philosophy discussion? What should you get out of this?
Well, it's political philosophy, right?
He's going to start out talking about liberty versus consequences. So he's going to make this denial that liberty and ultimately rights are this unequivocal good that aren't sort of limited by other factors.
And in fact, rights are not the foundation of good government in the sense of natural right.
Right. And then the other part of it, there's basically the people he's responding to, which includes this Reverend Dr. Price, who gave this sermon, to which this pamphlet is a direct response, to what they call the Revolution Society, which is the society in England, which was sympathetic to the French Revolution and excited about its ideas and its implications for England. They sort of, again, assimilated this to the Glorious Revolution and established these three principles, which they thought grew out of the Glorious Revolution, which were being reaffirmed by the French Revolution. And in the reading we have today, Burke is going to respond to those three principles in succession. Those three principles have to do with, we have the right to choose our own rulers, and we can get rid of them when they misbehave.
Cashier them.
And then we can, cashier them from misconduct. And then we can frame a government for ourselves. The reason why it's of philosophical interest is because he's going to challenge those three general principles in succession. And then he's going to challenge the idea that rights in this abstract sense are what we should see as the foundation of government. And he's going to champion things like religion and sentiment over rationality.
Well, and tradition. Where you came from is the only proper root of a government. And the idea that you could found a government on abstract principles at all, he finds absurd and dangerous.
So it wasn't just that Burke was opposed to the idea of using abstract reason to found government. Some of the additional research that I did, he's really anti-Enlightenment. You know, he's anti-scientific in some respects. And so his whole project is, this is not an expediency for the purposes of trying to justify a monarchy. It's more part of his overall approach, his resistance to Enlightenment rationalism that was starting to emerge, or that was in full bloom at that point.
Which means what exactly? What are the tenets of enlightened rationalism? We said you can't get principles like natural rights surely from reason.
No.
Is that essential to Enlightenment?
This idea of rights and their sort of preeminence. So the French Revolution, you know, you see a government completely overthrown whole cloth, and eventually, basically, they just destroy the church and confiscate all the land and basically tear everything up and start from scratch. And the idea is that you could do that if you, there's a great sort of intellectual confidence, you know, the philosophes and all of that sort of scientific and activity in France, where you knew by reason, you sort of had a design of the ideal government in your head. This, you know, rationally, you had established that. And all you had to do is put the right reasonable people in charge to execute that, and you're good. And of course, that's not what happened.
There's a great line in mine. It's on page 152. It's in the middle. And he's talking about the practicality of government and that we have to know about people. And he says at the end of the paragraph, in that deliberation, I shall always advise to call in the aid of the farmer and the physician rather than the professor of metaphysics.
Yeah, yeah. That whole section, those two paragraphs or two groups right there are really good. So Burke was preceded by Locke. And I think when I'm talking about Enlightenment and rationalism, the idea that Locke uses a reasoned approach to building up a theory of government based on rational principles and natural rights. So he argues in favor of acknowledging these natural rights, and then he builds through argument this notion of the social contract and the idea of agreement between individuals with adjudication by a third party as being the principle for government. And that is not the approach that Burke is taking, and it's not something that he would agree to. In other words, there's no justification for the specific government that he's intending to defend here, which is the English government, that comes from some sort of reasoning from discovered or abstract principles. It's more genealogical than that.
Yeah, it's ancient. It's what you've had before.
Yeah, not just because it's tradition, but basically because tradition is our best signpost for what's beneficial. He's making a consequentialist argument against a sort of rights-based conception of government. It's a kind of conflict we've seen many, many times before in our readings. Our calculus, the thing, first and foremost, we have to think about whether we are benefited by civil society and by our government. And that to the extent to which any adherence to a concept of rights endangers that, then we have to limit them.
Part of what goes hand in hand is the idea of who should be the people running that government and making that government for the sake of the benefit of society as a whole. And that leads him down basically an anti-democratic path, saying that, well, the people who are best equipped through experience and knowledge and role in society, those are the ones that ought to be running the government. And we simply can't expect that everyone can do it. And we can't expect that people in general will be able to choose those people well. And he spends a lot of time criticizing both the members of the French National Assembly and the composition thereof as being basically incompetent and warning of the dangers of that.
He talks about rights specifically on pages of 49 through 50 of my version. So he's first talking about rights as these people he objects to use it, which is sort of what's familiar to us, the abstract rights of men, rights of people. He says, against these, there can be no prescription. Against these, no argument is binding. These admit no temperament and no compromise. Anything withheld from their full demand is so much of fraud and injustice, right, according to the other position. Against these, their rights of men, let no government look for security in the length of its continuance or in the justice and leniency of its administration. The objections of these speculatists, if its forms do not quadrate with their theories, are as valid against such an old and beneficent government as against the most violent tyranny or the greenest usurpation. They are always at issue with governments, not on a question of abuse, but a question of competency and a question of title. I have nothing to say to the clumsy subtlety of their political metaphysics. That's one of his many tirades. So what does he mean there specifically? I mean, he earlier had been saying, well, just to make this clear, again, the full title is Reflections on the Revolution in France and on the Proceedings in Certain Societies in London Relative to that Event. So he's both criticizing what's going on in France and what might happen, what some people are proposing to happen in England.
I don't think the Revolution Society was proposing that things concretely change. In fact, I think they were trying to sort of rationalize English government as already exhibiting many of the virtues that were going to come about by the French Revolution to the French. So,
right. But one of the ways they describe it, which Burke says is wrong, is that we have these rights that the French were claiming to choose our own governors, to cashier them for misconduct, to frame a government for ourselves. And because, you know, it was a constitutional monarchy in Britain and there were a lot of protections, these people were describing that, as you say, Wes, as already fulfilling these goals. And Burke points out right away, like, wait a second, that doesn't seem to describe our monarchy at all. We don't have the right to get rid of. It seems like it casts our entire, it says every single king that we've ever had has been illegitimate.
Right.
It says it because they're not elected. There might be some far off in Burke engages in this himself, like to say somehow that the social compact, the original social compact somehow was an agreement among people. And so that kind of got the kings and their succession in line. But that's not the same, obviously, as an election. So it seems like the way things are going, if you believe in these rights, then you can point to any given thing and say, oh, you know, people have a right to, seems some of the things they were putting forward is like having a right to medicine, having a right to food, having a right to an equal share of riches, pointing out the way things are and saying that's illegitimate. And it's not a matter of it's illegitimate because the monarch or the whoever is abusing their authority, but just because of the way things are.
Burke does think there are rights.
Right. That's the next page. Yep. The real rights of men as opposed to these abstract ones.
So far am I from denying in theory, full as far is my heart from withholding in practice, if I were of power to give or to withhold, the real rights of men. In denying their false claims of right, that is the false claims of the Revolution Society, I do not mean to injure those which are real and are such as their pretended rights would totally destroy. In other words, these abstract rights, the idea of them could destroy our real rights. If civil society be made for the advantage of man, all the advantages for which it is made become his right. It is an institution of beneficence, and law itself is only beneficence acting by a rule. Men have a right to live by that rule. They have a right to justice, as between their fellows. Whether their fellows are in politic function or in ordinary occupation, they have a right to the fruits of their industry and to the means of making the industry fruitful. They have a right to the acquisitions of their parents, to the nourishment and improvement of their offspring, to instruction in life, and to consolation in death. Whatever each man can separately do without trespassing upon others, he has a right to do for himself, and he has a right to a fair portion of all which society, with all of its combinations of skill and force, can do in his favor. In this partnership, all men have equal rights, but not to equal things. So then he will go on to say, specifically, we do not have an equal right to govern ourselves.
To judge our own cause.
Well, yeah, that's sort of a higher principle that he's appealing to, but he says, yeah. But he has not a right to an equal dividend in the product of the joint stock. And as to the share of power, authority, and direction, which each individual ought to have in the management of the state, that I must deny to be amongst the direct original rights of man and civil society.
The last sentence in there is also important. It says, it is a thing to be settled by convention. So part of this is the rights that he's describing, they don't seem to me to be natural rights. He doesn't seem to be arguing that they're natural rights born out of us as human beings, but they are the real rights that are born out of our traditions, our conventions.
Right. So he does think there are natural rights, but those are the Hobbesian natural rights that we give up in civil society, like the right to defend ourselves, to kill people willy-nilly, to do all of the nasty, brutish, and short types of things. Those are natural rights. It's the same section where he talks about this, actually. We give up those things for the rights that come from civil society. And those are the real rights. Those are the rights which he will talk about as sort of being the relevance of tradition here is that we sort of inherit those rights.
In the next paragraph, one of the first motives of civil society, which becomes one of its fundamental rules, is that no man should be judge in his own cause. By this, each person has at once divested himself of the first fundamental right of uncovenanted man, that is, to judge for himself and to assert his own cause. He abdicates all right to be his own governor. He inclusively, and in great measure, abandons the right of self-defense, the first law of nature. Men cannot enjoy the rights of an uncivil and of a civil state together. That they may obtain justice, he gives up his right of determining what it is in points the most essential to him. That he may secure some liberty, he makes a surrender in trust of the whole of it.
Right. So this is like a summary of Hobbes there.
Yeah, and he's emphasizing that in particular, that the only way we get justice is by giving up rights, at least the right to take it in our own course and judge for ourselves. And in that way, it sort of reminds me of something we brought up a number of times is in the end of the Oresteia and the whole idea that you have a government or a civil society in which you no longer have an eye for an eye and individual revenge in order to make the civil society work. You give up the right to be judge and jury for the things that happen to you. He says next, government is not made in virtue of natural rights. And a little later, government is a contrivance of human wisdom to provide for human wants. Men have a right that these wants should be provided for by his wisdom. Among these wants is to be reckoned the want out of civil society of a sufficient restraint upon the passions. In this sense, the restraints on men, as well as their liberties, are to be reckoned among their rights. So that's an interesting turn, that we have the right to have other people restrained.
We have the right to be nanny-stated.
I think, actually, there's something to be said about the use of the term civil society. This is ultimately a justification of government, but because it's not a treatise where he's trying to justify the existence of any particular government or a particular form of government using abstract principles, it's not really an argument per se. And we should pay attention to his concept of civil society. It's less about the idea that government itself or this government or that government. It's more about the community of human beings that are coexisting in a civil society. Government is a mechanism, but it's the order of the civil society that he's most concerned about. What horrified him about the French Revolution when he wrote this, even before the worst atrocities had happened, was terror, chaos and terror, not, well, tyranny of a sort. He sort of doesn't acknowledge the notion of tyranny, you know, in terms of a traditional notion, a tyranny of the majority or tyranny of the mob versus tyranny of a king or a queen. But what's underlying this discourse here is a concern to maintain order. And insofar as government is the organism by which that happens or the mechanism by which that happens, then he's talking about government. But he's really much more concerned about not completely disrupting the fabric of civil society, which goes far beyond, I think, government.
Yeah, and all the good things that come with that. So it's not order for order's sake, but it's there are all these good things that we take for granted that are predicated on that order.
And in that way, it seems to me that the form of that order, he's not going to fall on a sword for. And so in defending the monarchy, he's not defending it in principle. He's defending it in existence right now, right?
Yep.
Yeah. He's defending it as its own sort of inheritance. He's defending it as a custom that's been passed down to us and that through the test of time has been shown to be functional, at least in his, you know.
Revision.
Yeah. Well,
would admit it, revision.
It has been revised. Yes. So there's a constitutional monarchy.
Right, right. The irony of this is, of course, was the English monarchy really that functional? I mean, the history of chaos and war. I mean, you could look at a lot of English history as sort of this centuries and centuries of bloodbath, much of which involved this tension either between the king and nobles or eventually between the monarchy and the parliament, but ultimately trying to settle like a balance of power between rulers and people, between the monarch and parliament or the representatives of the people. And yeah, they had a good thing, you know, after the Glorious Revolution, they were doing well. But you can't ignore the centuries of terror that preceded that. So that's one little side commentary there, I think, that people ought to think about.
And also, how great and just was it for ordinary people? Right? I mean, there's a little bit of through rose-colored glasses going on.
He's writing this from the perspective of somebody who's benefited from that order. And the criticisms that he got afterwards were, you know, people defending the French Revolution, talking about the state of the peasants and a variety of the terrible things that were going on at the time. So I don't know if we want to get into talking about that as validating or invalidating his claim, but it has to be acknowledged that that's the perspective from which he's having this conversation.
Well, I think he could admit that there are lots of things wrong. And still, really, this isn't about whether a constitutional monarchy is ideal or it may not even be the best form of government, right? It may be a terrible form of government, but it belongs somewhere on that Aristotelian scale of governments. But the question is how you get from A to B. The question is how you institute reforms. And in that sense, he's going to be on the side of gradualism. And this is sort of, I think, something we saw with Crito as well, under my interpretation. But, you know, even if there are bad laws, there's something to be said for obedience to those laws. And even if our government is not ideal, there's something to be said for reverence and respect for that government and not simply throwing it to the wayside to start from scratch, but starting with what you have and trying to reform gradually from within. So it's really an argument about the circumstances in which revolution are allowable. And it's not even like he's saying that revolution is never allowable. That's the interesting thing here. He has conditions under which revolution is a legitimate way to go. But I think in the specific case of France, he thinks that it was not the way to go and its consequences were bound to be terrible in his view. So that's one of the most important measures of whether or not you're going to have a revolt, not whether your rights are being trampled upon, but whether you can actually improve things by having a revolution.
Yeah.
And the revolution should be a matter of removing the abusive element, not changing the system. Like, if you're going to change the system, it should be when things are otherwise calm and you can sort of have a very slow evolution, a tweaking of introducing things. You don't use the opportunity when a particular ruler is being abusive. If you're going to chuck him out, then the justification to that, as he thought in the 1688 revolution, should be, we're fixing something that has gone awry. We're actually returning to something more ancient, perhaps.
He uses this word necessity. So, Mark, you're referring to the point where he's basically addressing the choosing your own governors principle, mm-hmm. choosing your own rulers. And he's trying to point out that the Glorious Revolution wasn't predicated on this right to choose our own rulers, but really it was just settling this question. It was reaffirming the whole principle of succession among kings, but it was kind of settling a question in succession, which is basically whether a Catholic could continue to inherit the crown because people didn't like that. You know, and then he uses this phrase for the peace, quiet, and security of the realm and the necessary for this certainty in succession. So in other words, it's this pragmatic, practical problem. Basically, everything's going to go to shit if you don't have a revolution. And that's the necessity that bears down upon you. And then he'll later on say in the right section, so at that point, you're not even within the realm of law anymore. It's not about the king has done something unlawful or they've trampled on my rights and I'm responding by reasserting the law and my rights. You're in a state of war now. You're completely outside of the realm of the law. You're in the realm of necessity, and you're acting to reestablish the realm in which law is relevant. You're in the chaos now, and you've got to reestablish order. And that's when revolution is the right way to go, but not when you already have order and you're just going to create chaos.
Right. So if the king were to try to abolish parliament, something like that is going too far. Or parliament should vote to abolish itself. He thinks they just can't do stuff like that. That would throw things into chaos.
That's what he's saying. But is it as simple as, I mean, isn't one man's order is another man's chaos, right? I mean, let's take seriously the idea that somebody's genuinely being subjugated, but there's order. If you're under the boot heel, but there's order in society, how does that make sense? I'm not saying that that's what the condition of the French Revolution was. I mean, I think that's a separate question. Now, to me, part of his point was also, if you have a revolution, it can't be just to break the government that's there. It has to be to put something else in its place. Otherwise, all you'll get is chaos. But I think that's going to be a hard challenge, especially if you are in a deeply subjugated position where just breaking the government is going to be about all you can think about. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have so many areas of the world that often just have one kind of revolution and period of chaos after another, is because they're just trying to end what's oppressing them. But they don't have a plan for how to sort it out afterwards.
So this goes to what the rights of the, you know, he thinks that stratification of society is natural. If you tried to equalize, it doesn't work. So you just put the wrong person on the top if you get in there and manually mess with the outcome of this natural process.
Yes, those who attempt to level never equalize, he says.
Hey, folks, I want to take a moment here to say thank you to St. John's College Graduate Institute, who is sponsoring this podcast, and tell you a little bit about what they do there. St. John's is founded really on one of the simplest, oldest activities that human beings have ever done, and that is conversation. There's no props, no pretense. It's just folks sitting around talking about a book.
They have an Eastern Classics program, the traditions of India, China, and Japan, and they do the Western Classics.
St. John's College has two campuses, one in Santa Fe and one in Annapolis. Dylan, what's your relationship to that?
So I taught at the Annapolis campus in the undergraduate program mainly. But both campuses have graduate programs.
One of the things that differentiates St. John's was that they're really interested in getting people engaged with issues and questions that are raised by the text. It's not really vocational or professional training, and that's a good thing.
Yes, and it ends up being more transformational of the individual student and their engagement both with their intellectual life and their engagement with the world.
Yeah, what we're doing with Partially Examined Life validates that, because for the last 8 years that we've been recording this podcast and engaging with text and issues and questions, I myself have been transformed. And so I can highly recommend this as an approach to education. Now, if you're a PEL citizen, a fan, or even a casual listener, and you would like to get together with folks just like you in a more formal and intimate setting to explore these great texts, to explore great questions, to feed your mind and your soul, you should check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, you can visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone, and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
I think we should talk more about the social contract, because that's what it comes down to, that he thinks that, as with Hobbes, even if you come out with the short end of the stick in society's lottery, you still have, in some sense, agreed to it. You're committed to it. And then the thing that he's adding here is it's not just that we have the right to be protected and, you know, whatever pitiful amount of property we have the right to keep that and not have it stolen from us or not have it taken away by the government. But if there really was a terrific, horrible distinction between rich and poor, such that people are actually starving, I think he's going to say that as long as the government can do something about it, then everybody, he said, you have the right to the share of what the government, of what the society can bring out. So it seems like there are going to be limits to how bad the disparity can be.
I don't know. I think the way to frame the question is, you know, suppose you have horrible poverty. The question is whether you try and solve that through legislation, through the mechanisms already present in society, or whether you think that there's no way that that can be done anymore and that revolution is the only way you're going to get there. I think he'd probably come out strongly in favor of the idea that you're never going to have perfect enough knowledge to say that the existing mechanisms within a society aren't there ultimately to solve a problem like desperate inequality. Mm-hmm. Now, you're right. He does think that a certain amount of inequality is inevitable.
And the need to have order is going to trump an awful lot of inequality, in his opinion, right?
Right. Yeah. So again, what have we agreed to when we agree to the social contract? That if we read Hobbes, it sounded like anything is better than the state of nature. It seems that Burke wants to say something more robust from that. And the place in the text where he talks about this, this is on page 80. It says, society is indeed a contract. So right before that paragraph, he actually gives a nice metaphor about revolution. To avoid the evils of inconstancy and versatility, which he thinks that the French assembly is guilty of, 10,000 times worse than those of obstinacy and the blindest prejudice, we have consecrated the state, that no man should approach to look into its defects or corruptions, but with due caution, that he should never dream of beginning its reformation by its subversion, that he should approach to the faults of the state as to the wounds of a father, with pious awe and trembling solicitude. By this wise prejudice, we are taught to look with horror on those children of their country who are prompt rashly to hack that aged parent in pieces and put him into the kettle of magicians in hopes that by their poisonous weeds and wild incantations, they may regenerate the paternal constitution and renovate their father's life. So I just thought that was a great formulation of that. Reform, not revolution. So right after that, he says, society is indeed a contract. Subordinate contracts for objects of mere occasional interest may be dissolved at pleasure, but the state ought not to be considered as nothing better than a partnership agreement in a trade of pepper and coffee or some other low concern to be taken up for a little temporary interest and to be dissolved by the fancy of the parties. It is to be looked on with other reverence because it is not a partnership in things subservient only to the gross animal existence of a temporary and perishable nature. It is a partnership in all science, a partnership in all art, a partnership in every virtue and in all perfection. As the ends of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born. Each contract of each particular state is but a clause in the great primeval contract of eternal society, linking the lower with the higher natures, connecting the visible and invisible world according to a fixed compact sanctioned by the inviolable oath which holds all physical and all moral natures, each in their appointed place.
This is completely unsupportable.
Why?
It's the boldest statement with absolutely no justification. I mean, if you're going to use the term contract, now granted, when we talk about Hobbes and we talk about Locke, and you only have to rewind 7 years to go listen to those episodes, folks, we always had this idea of the question about whether you could opt out of the contract. You're born into a society. Do you have the option to opt out of the contract? And in this context, Burke is thinking about what took place in the United States, where in essence, right, the American Revolution, which he sanctioned, was an opting out of the contract with the sovereign.
He actually didn't sanction the revolution itself. anyway.
But also the argument would be that if you were to support the American Revolution, you say the sovereign opted out first.
Sorry. I was under the impression, maybe I misread, I don't want to have a conversation with him about.
It's not in the current reading, so it was, yeah.
The point is though, to say that you're born into a contract, the contract between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born, and simultaneously to say earlier that it's essentially contingent because it's not founded on abstract principles or reason. It's just merely a fact of the way things have happened to unfold, which is tradition. He has no justification. He's not trying to even justify it. He's not trying to claim that, yeah, this is the way it is, but it's the right way.
He rejects that out of hand, right? He rejects the notion that there would be a justification of those kinds of principles. He says there is no such justification.
Right.
Government is a convention. It is a practical endeavor.
There is a justification. It's just consequences, good or bad consequences. It's a kind of proto-pragmatism at work here.
It's a convention you're born into and you must accept that you have no right to question.
So let me defend
fascist
this idea, because I think I've been fascinated by this idea since the Crito, that in some sense you've made an agreement just by being born into a situation. And I think, Seth, on one level, you're completely right. But if we try and look at this in a more sophisticated way, and I think it's consistent with Burke, because he's thinking about some of these things in the text. On the one hand, you say, like Socrates did, well, you've made this tacit agreement because you enjoy the benefits of the society and you don't leave, even though you could leave. So sort of a love it or leave it, or as we saw, persuade it or leave it, you know, because you also have the opportunity to persuade society to change without simply revolting or disobeying the law. But the more subtle way of understanding agreement is the whole idea of being constituted by society. And that's where tradition becomes very important. We aren't just blank slates, little individual atoms in society. We are constituted by our customs and our mores and the sort of things which ultimately feed into the laws. In a way, it's sort of like the laws are valid to us because we are constructed beforehand via those laws. Those laws go into creating us, into making us who we are. And there's some sense in which that's the way we have agreed to them, even though we haven't agreed as a conscious matter, but we've agreed in our constitution. We've agreed in the sense in which we are preconformed to them.
In that rational way, they would also always be up for constant revision. In the language that we just read, I share some of Seth's indignation in that he's going very strong for the inviolability of it, as opposed to the conventionality of it, which would admit of constant pragmatic revision. It's a very different emphasis.
Well, it's in the same paragraph, though, that he allows for revolution. Shall I read?
Yeah.
It is the first and supreme necessity only, a necessity that is not chosen but chooses, a necessity paramount to deliberation that admits no discussion and demands no evidence, which alone can justify a resort to anarchy. This is where I said you're outside of the domain of law. Mm-hmm. Once you reach the point of revolution, it's not a matter of, oh, I'm asserting my rights and you've done something illegal to me. You are in the state of war. This necessity is not exception to the rule, because this necessity itself is a part two of that moral and physical disposition of things to which man must be obedient by consent or force. In other words, necessity is his own sort of law. But if that which is only submission to necessity should be made the object of choice, the law is broken, nature is disobeyed, and the rebellious are outlawed, cast forth and exiled from this world of reason and order and peace and virtue and fruitful penitence into the antagonist world of madness, discord, vice, confusion, and unavailing sorrow.
Yeah.
So even in revolution, there's a sense in which we are subject to a certain kind of law, weirdly enough.
You mean necessity and the world of madness, discord, vice, confusion, and unavailing sorrow?
No, the necessity is not an exception to the rule or the law, because this necessity itself is a part two of that moral and physical disposition of things to which we must be obedient by consent or force. In other words, this is the whole analogy between moral law and natural law. So there's a sense in which when we are pushed to the point of revolution, it's not a matter of choice. It's a determined moment. It's not a matter of reflection. In a sense, it simply happens to us. Things have gotten that bad. The moment of necessity is the moment of revolution.
I just feel like he's also saying that at that moment, law is broken. You're in sort of a different category of things. You're outside of the world of reason, order, peace, and virtue.
The law is only broken if the revolution is a matter of choice rather than necessity. So if your revolution is a matter of necessity, there is no exception to the rule. If it's a matter of choice, the law is broken.
Well, I think he's being confusing there because he is contrasting necessity and law, where law is, on the one hand, a natural law a la Hobbes, and that's where necessity is coming in, or law is a convention a la the government that we have. And if you have a revolution, you're certainly breaking that law, but you may be obeying the law of necessity.
Well, I think he sees them as belonging on a spectrum, right? So where we might think of the law and rights as sort of these abstract things generated from wherever you might think they come from, for him, they're part and parcel. When we're thinking of tradition, we're thinking of necessity. We're thinking of a kind of determinism at work. And so our what we call rights and laws, those are just things handed down to us. And they are just riding the deterministic wave. And they are laws for us, not because they're necessarily abstractly the perfect thing, but because they're just the things that were handed down and that we suspect have some relationship to good consequences, because tried and true experience develops that kind of correlation over time between practice and consequence.
Yeah, but I thought he was very clear that that correlation is not necessity. That correlation is convention. I took him as making a very strong argument that convention is a very strong force and it has all kinds of things that are good about it.
Yeah, I see convention as a form of necessity.
Well, okay, so that's, I guess, where I'm disagreeing. It seems to be that he's distinguishing those two things.
So take, for instance, the existentialist contrast between, you know, the ambivalence that de Beauvoir talks about, between the necessity of character and the things that grow out of character, habit, and then out of habit, custom, out of custom, law. Those are all within the realm of necessity. And then choice.
Necessity or consequence?
Necessity in the sense of determinism. You know, our characters are not a matter of our choice. We are bred in a certain way, and our genes and our environment determine who we are. Customs grow out of...
Yeah, necessity is a terrible word for that then. Consequence, you know, that there's an entanglement, that makes sense. But necessity is a terrible word for that.
Well, it's just the lingo that they used. Because it's necessity in terms of one thing must follow another. So a certain kind of consequence must follow a cause. And that shows up, again, in character. It shows up in the custom. It shows up in the law. So in other words, in a weird way, our laws, you could think of them as coming from on high, from God or truth or something, but you could think of them as simply the effects of necessity in the sense of the deterministic forces of the universe, as opposed to law thought of, again, in the more rational Enlightenment sense, as these truths that we can sort of pluck from the heavens or from our reflection, and the same thing with rights.
You're making me want to go back and revisit this form of necessity that you're talking about. I see how Burke may be doing that, making a claim of natural necessity along the lines that you're talking about. But it does seem to be in tension with the very pragmatic accretionist entanglement that he's talking about, which has some features of cause and effect, but they're not strictly speaking cause and effect that way.
Well, let's agree that the primary sense of necessity here is when push comes to shove and revolution becomes inevitable. Let's just put it that way. And then the rest of it we can interpret, but it gets more complicated.
Go ahead, Mark.
So the laws that a government makes do not happen by nature. They're the choices of human beings. So in that sense, I mean, I looked up the phrase rule of law, and it only occurs once very early on, where he's talking about, you know, when revolution does happen, it did happen in the 1688 revolution. It was wise of them not to turn this case of necessity into a rule of law, into saying, okay, well, every time something like this happens, we're going to replace the ruler. Every time they do something we don't like, we're not going to have articles of impeachment written into our law books.
not just articles of impeachment, the idea of revolution, right, which Price and company seem to be supporting, the idea that if you're upset with your government, take up arms and overthrow it. That's the right of the people always to hold the...
What other mechanism do they have in this context?
Well, I think this is where the whole issue of spectrum comes along, right? I think it's pretty easy to see that there are cases where there would be little option but to do such a thing. And there are plenty of cases to see where just because you disagree with your government doesn't mean that you ought to be taking armed revolt. I mean, the American government's one example, but you know, there are other governments where the whole idea is to come up with a way to transfer power from one vested interest to another in a way that doesn't lead to total chaos and anarchy and bloodletting. And that's the trick, right? But it makes demands both on the government, but also on the society as a whole.
I mean, the condition, which he says explicitly, I haven't been able to find it, there really are cases in which the government can violate the contract.
Sure.
The difficulty becomes, you know, that's such a vague criterion, right? And when is it just, you know, how do you know you're right? And you're rationalizing your revolutionary activity. How do you know that this is really the case in which the government is basically violated, is no longer a government in a sense? And so the revolt is a necessity. How can you know that you're right about that and that you're not just, don't just have grievances, which might ultimately be resolved within the mechanisms available within the state, within the society?
I think you know because you try to use the existing mechanisms. And he thinks that even if you can't, for instance, the common people, there's the House of Commons. Now, they don't vote for the representative in the House of Commons. He talks a little about how the representatives were in there, and he describes it as some sort of meritocracy that somehow, you know, the most landed people among the commoners, I don't know exactly how it was chosen, but in any case, it's the job of that body to represent the common people. And if they are not doing that, there's something wrong. And the first way of addressing that would be, well, to point out that their behavior is wrong. And he really relies a lot on there being a common ethic, that you need not just laws, but you need religion, because there's a common morality and practices based on tradition, that so much of this law, what makes society work, is unwritten. It's a shared thing. You should be able to point to the tradition and make an argument in whatever the house is. So everybody has their own duties. And he talks about how the people with more responsibility, with more power, they need to be even more holy, more under the thumb of the teachings of the church to ensure that they are doing their duty properly.
And this is where he's so sanguine, right? In a kind of rosy understanding of the nobles will exercise their obligations to civil society appropriately and not just be rapacious thugs.
Mm-hmm.
His view of nobility is one that, you know, you hear all the time when people talk about a great ruler who's taking the concerns of the people in mind and being the, you know, the father of the country and so forth. But it just seems to fly in face of the actual experience of over and over and over again, nobles just being some version of thugs who managed to get more than everybody else has.
However, I mean, how much real experience do you have of nobles? I think this is part of what, there's a quote here about how when you argue that all priests are bastards and we should hang them all, you know, which is one of the arguments that was made by these people in the French Revolution, or that all the nobles are rapacious and oppressive, it's like you're reacting to a satire that you've heard. You know, you read Molière, or in our case, you know, this is exactly what we often do, is that we revel in these stereotypes of the worst kind of illiterate hick who just has his gun and is going to, you know, or the most incompetent bureaucrats. They're all just lazy. And but no, if you actually work in government or you live in the South and deal with people, no, you find, for the most part, there's some bad apples, but people are, it makes sense for them to try to be good, mm-hmm, for exactly the reasons Aristotle pointed out. You know, they have to live in this society. The parasite is of necessity an exception. And he thinks, yes, you could have a society that is so dysfunctional that the nobility I think he would say this about the Wall Street people now. I mean, he makes these kind of predictions about if you get rid of nobles, you know who's going to be the nobles of the future? It's going to be like the money lenders. Like he kind of predicts the current nobility that we have here. And he might say that that kind of class, just the structure of what they do is so screwed up and not founded properly in traditions and religion and the sense of them having a duty to the rest of society because they're rich or anything.
Yep. The idea of honor instead of just self-interest.
And, it could be that, that those guys really just are corrupt in virtue, not because they're all bad people, but just because of the incentives in the structure of the social place that they inhabit.
Yeah. So he says later on, towards the end of what we read, that the foundation of civilization is the spirit of religion and the spirit of a gentleman.
Yeah. And talks specifically in France about like, look, I knew some of the nobles there. I know, you know, I'm sure there were some rapacious thugs.
Some of my best friends are nobles.
Some of them were obviously honorable people. And has a similarly long defense of the clergy, and to just dismiss them and, you know, whatever the individual abuses might have been, and surely there were some, isn't it better to have some abuses than to just trash the whole thing and have chaos?
So I think that one of the rubs there, I think you're making a lot of sense, Mark. And
Slash Burke,
yes. Sorry. Yeah, no, that's right. But one of the challenges there is the complicity that even if you have a whole bunch of nobles, you know, one of the challenges, if you are under the thumb of the one or two rapacious nobles, which I don't know if there was only one or two, right? But that the other nobles know about it and they don't do anything, right? It helps a lot to have people who are in power. Let's say a big group of them are doing their best and really making pretty reasonable judgments about these things. But then they also don't take care of the people who aren't doing such things. They aren't fixing that all the time. Now, Burke might be an example against this, right? Because he made this big suit against this guy, Warren Hastings, the East India Company in India, and that he was ruining India. I don't know the details. I just read a little bit about it in Wikipedia. But it seemed like the kind of thing where he was saying, look, you're being a bastard. You know, you are not fulfilling your obligations to the role that you have. So Burke put his money where his mouth was.
Yeah, I thought Mark's talk of incentives was spot on because, you know, when Burke is criticizing the composition of the French National Assembly and all the sort of lowlifes that are brought in. So it sounds very elitist, and he talks about average lawyers and sort of country clowns and your average professional who he thinks are like poorly suited to that job because really their incentive structure in society, the way they're sort of conditioned, is to be self-interested. And he thinks that the landed interest in the nobility actually have other incentives, oddly enough. They already have the property and money and don't have to worry about that. And what they're interested chiefly in is their honor. That's a completely different type of incentive, which I think Burke thinks is a really good thing for society, to have people for whom honor is this big, big deal. It affects the structure of society and its mores at a very deep level. So when we lose that, even though there are some rapacious thugs among the nobility and there's all sorts of abuses, and as a part of the structure of society, to lose that is to lose something profound.
And posterity, that part of honor, is passing on your holdings, passing on your family name, is this connection between generations, past and future, which is a good incentive, he thinks.
Yeah. So no death tax, no estate taxes, no confiscation of the estates of rich people instead of letting them leave it to their children, because there's a sense in which that's odd and unjust, just patrimony. I think he thinks that continuity of inheritance that he mentions a few times and the importance of property, maybe that's what we should talk about since he mentions that so frequently.
All right, well, why don't we start off our second half talking about inheritance, since we've run out of time for now. However, since we're going to be talking more in just a few minutes, why don't you listen to the rest of it right now as well? If you're hearing this, then you are on the public version, and there's also a special PEL Citizen version of this episode, which doesn't have any advertisements and combines the first half of the discussion and the second half of the discussion in one nice file available on our Citizen feed that you set it up just once. It's very easy on your phone, and you get not only all the ad-free versions, the whole thing at the same time when it comes out, but a lot of extra bonus content. So go right now, sign up to be a Partially Examined Life citizen. Otherwise, we'll talk to you in a week. See ya.
For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB.